Welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, hosted by Dr. Ryan Mauley and Travis Buzzell. Join us on this journey as we educate the patient population, inform today's medical providers, and inspire tomorrow's medical leaders through education and in-depth discussion. We can all discover today's best healthcare solutions. Now, sit back and enjoy Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters.
Hey, everybody. Dr. Ryan Sawbones Mauley here, and welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters. I'm here joined with my co-host,
Travis Buzzell.
And before we get started, I just want to urge you guys to like, subscribe, leave comments, leave suggestions. If you have any guests you'd like to see us have on this show, you know, that's what this is all about, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, any feedback, comments, things like that. I mean, we do respond. We do enjoy those conversations. So please, any feedback that you can provide, like, subscribe, guests, those sort of things. We love hearing recommendations.
And I'm excited about tonight's guest. Yeah, same. I mean, this has been one that I've been following for a while on LinkedIn. Her presence has grown over the past several months. I've just interestedly watched everything that she's kind of done. She has a couple different passions in life, one of which is one of mine, which is orthopedic surgery. But why don't you do the introduction, Trav?
Yeah. So again, I mean, you turned me on to our guest probably maybe a month or so ago, and you said, "Hey, if you're not following on LinkedIn, like, you know, you really need to start following." So Dr. Towson, thank you so much for joining us. And so really excited to, you know, chat with you a little bit and learn a little bit more about who you are and, you know, how you got to where you are now. And just if you could give us the 30,000 foot view of kind of
a little inside joke there. I always say 30,000. He always says 10,000 foot. I'm like, come on, it's
10,000 feet. Yeah. But yeah, just a little background of, you know, kind of who you are, where you're from, where you went to school, how you got started, all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to be on. I'm really thrilled to be here and chat with you guys. And I've been really enjoying growing a presence on LinkedIn and creating a really nice network and meeting a lot of great people that way. So I actually grew up in New Jersey. So I'm a Jersey girl. And then I went to college and medical school in and around Philadelphia. First doctor in my family. So just kind of thought I always wanted to be a doctor, but didn't really necessarily have a specific direction I wanted to go in. Athlete, played lacrosse in college, high school and college. So went through a knee injury, ACL surgery in college, and really then went under the wing of my surgeon, and he really became my mentor. So that really is why, in large part, why I wanted to be in orthopedics. Went to Pittsburgh for my residency. So I lived out there for 7 years, actually. Got married right before I started residency, had my two daughters during residency. So not the easiest thing when you're the first woman in the program and then you're pregnant twice in the program. So it was an interesting time, but I will say I had a very supportive group of residents that I worked with, and the attendings I worked under were fabulous as well. So especially being the first woman, it was you know, an interesting time. And then I ended up coming back to the Philadelphia area to do my fellowship at Jefferson, and then have settled in this area. So I've been in my current practice for 18 years. I had one job prior to that. Immediately after fellowship, I was hospital employed in a small hospital for 2 years. My kids were very young and it was very close to where I lived, so it worked out nicely. And then I joined my practice in 2006. And I've been there ever since. So with the focus primarily on sports medicine, I did a sports fellowship, but I do, my niche is kind of the shoulder. So I do everything in the shoulder, sports, arthroplasty, and my daughters are all grown up and life is pretty good overall.
Awesome. So your story is so similar to a lot of other orthopedic surgeons, right? It was either an injury or somebody that helped to influence, or you were an athlete and it just happened to be both. You were a high school, college, lacrosse athlete, ACL injury. So I guess my first question is, when are you getting your total knee and who's doing it?
Great question.
I saw your x-ray on LinkedIn a couple of times and I was like, oh,
Yeah.
Seen that one before. Yeah. A couple times a week when I'm doing total knees on those.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I played lacrosse again through high school and college. I tore my ACL and had surgery my sophomore year in college. I went to Haverford here outside of Philadelphia. And Dr. Larry Miller was the team physician at Haverford. He had also been a Haverford student. He graduated from Haverford years prior. And he really became a mentor for me. So I missed my sophomore season, but then went back and played, you know, junior and senior year. When I always, again, wanted to be a doctor, but actually during that time in college, when I was going through my rehab and everything, I kind of toyed with the idea of physical therapy or doing something else. So I had a little bit of uncertainty right as I was graduating college. So I took a year off, like the gap year or whatever you want to call it. I actually applied to both medical school and physical therapy school at the same time. And during that year, I worked at Haverford as like an assistant to the athletic trainer. And then Larry Miller invited me into his office to observe. And so I went in and shadowed him in the office. He took me into the OR a few times, and that kind of sealed the deal. I was like, no, this is what I need to do. Right. And interestingly, I got into all the medical schools that I applied to and none of the physical therapy schools I applied to. Wow. I didn't really have the right prereqs for it. So I just did it, but it's a sort of an interesting thing. Like I was accepted to all the med schools, but not the PT schools. So anyway, so on I went, but he remained a very strong influence for me, and that's really why I wanted to, you know, go into orthopedics and even more specifically sports medicine.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question because, you know, as you start orthopedics, we all do our different rotations, whether it's trauma, peds, hand, foot and ankle, joints, sports, spine, yeah, whatever it may be. And, you know, it feels like you do a rotation like, oh, this is what I want to do. And then, this is what I want to do. Yeah. I originally wanted to do sports myself because I was an athletic trainer in undergrad.
Okay.
Worked the first 2 years of medical school, was doing some athletic training work and working tons of camps during the summer, and was a former athlete too. So it kind of jived with that. I really liked the arthroscopic surgery. Mm-hmm. But then when I got into a total joint room, I mean, the light just shined right in my eyes. And I was like, no, this is exactly what I would do.
It's kind of funny that all the conversations that we've had since, you know, the inception of, you know, Red Carpet and the podcast itself, like that is one of the common things that I continually just resonate with me and that I hear over and over. And I mean, your story, and I mean, obviously Dr. Townsend, your story is sort of like, okay, I kind of get to this place, I'm kind of going this direction, and then boom, I'm in an OR one day shadowing, and it's like, okay, this is what I want to do. I feel like we've just heard that continuously over and over and over. And from, you know, someone on the outside that obviously is not on the physician side, obviously, you know, seeing that, it's like, I mean, that makes sense because you have to want to do that, right? Because, you know, people aren't like, oh, blood, or, you know, gonna pass out, or I don't like that. People that are, I feel like, naturally meant to or maybe drawn to that sort of thing, I mean, it does make sense that you see it and you're like, something clicks and that's what you want to do.
Yeah, for sure. Now, the other thing that was interesting to me that we kind of share in common as well is both you and I spent a couple of years as hospital employed physician. So my first year I was in private practice. I was employed, but private practice, multi-specialty group. Second and third years I stayed in the same practice, but my employer actually became the hospital that I was in. So I was practicing alongside the same people. But the hospital was actually subsidizing the practice for the space, the staff, the x-rays. And I knew like within the first week that hospital employment was not for me.
Right.
Did you have a similar experience or?
So my experience was I was doing my fellowship. During my fellowship year, I was working at Jefferson, so downtown Philadelphia. When we moved back here from Pittsburgh, so I'll back up just a smidge, because at the end of my residency, my chief year, I had two small children. I had a two-year-old and a baby, and that's when my marriage fell apart too. So during that time, I was making a lot of quick decisions about what I was going to do and how I was going to manage coming back to Philadelphia for my fellowship in sports medicine at Jefferson. And so what happened was I moved my parents, who helped me tremendously all throughout my career and raising my kids, had moved out to Pittsburgh to help when I got pregnant the first time. So my mother has basically been my, you know, my children's caregiver since they were both born. So we were making a big decision at that point because my marriage was ending, that we were all going to move back this way and we were all going to move in together. So within a matter of months, we were making that decision, trying to find a house, moving back from Pittsburgh, you know, east. And so when we did, we ended up in southern Chester County, which is kind of about nearly an hour from Philadelphia. It just was the house that was ready and we could move in and merge the family, you know, together. And about 5 minutes down the road from that house is this little kind of rinky dink hospital that didn't have the best reputation in the world, had one orthopedic surgeon working there. I was aware of it, but I didn't really know too much about it. So as I'm ending my fellowship, one of the guys I was working with my fellowship's like, where are you going to work? I have a 1-year-old. I have a 3-year-old. My parents are helping with the kids. He's like, what are we going to do? I was like, well, there's this little hospital right down the road from where I live. And he's like, all right, let's get him on the phone. So he picks up the phone. You know, we're done in the OR. We go up to his office, picks up the phone, is on the phone. And within 5 minutes with the CEO of this hospital, because it wasn't that hard to do because the hospital was so small. And I get an interview. I go and that's where I end up. And it was very convenient, very close to where I lived. They had one orthopedic surgeon there who right off the bat said to me, if you come, I'm leaving. Okay. So he...
Welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
Roll out the red carpet.
Exactly.
Literally.
So it was during the time, a little bit of the malpractice crisis here in Pennsylvania, you know, and in this region. And so he was looking to actually move potentially to Delaware to get to a different state to get away from some of that. So fair enough. I mean, but he said, yeah, I mean, if they take you here, then, you know, it's my easy exit, so to speak. And so that is what happened. So then I became hospital employed. I was by myself. His practice, he was also like private practice, but subsidized by the hospital kind of deal. So when he left, like his patients went, I mean, some of them, you know, stayed and ultimately came to me, but I literally had this little office with like 3 exam rooms, a front desk person who was also the biller, who was also the MA, who was also, and then like I had 2 people working with me and no charts on the rack, like nothing, and just started this little practice. And then within 2 years, I built it up to something reasonably good. And then they wanted to hire somebody else. And that was fine, but the reputation of the hospital was not good. So they were really struggling to find somebody and they were willing to take anybody. And I wasn't willing to work with anybody. So then that was kind of the writing on the wall for me, was that they're going to make a decision. They're going to bring on who they want, regardless of what I've done in the past 2 years. And that's, you know, just not something that I'm comfortable with. And then I was making connections in the area and the group I ultimately went to, they kind of recruited me to join them because their sports guy relocated. So my experience was just more that they were, you know, certainly in control of me and they were going to make some changes and decisions that I wasn't happy with.
So I understand it was a rinky-dink hospital, but were you taking call 24/7, 365?
I had made the deal when I was there or when I had, before I started, that I was going to be on call every third night. And that the other orthopedic surgeon was potentially still going to be there. And then they had another group that was like, did some cases there, but wasn't technically, you know, there. They were more at a different hospital and took some call. And so it was supposed to be every third night. And then, you know, upon me signing the contract, the one guy left and the other guy stopped taking call there. So it was me all the time. But it was so small that it really wasn't, you know, a huge problem. I technically told them that I'm still just really on call. Every third night's what I signed in my contract, but I lived 5 minutes away. They called me if there was an issue. Usually I didn't have to go in very often anyway, even though I was really the only gal in town.
Did they have any mid-levels to help support you at all?
I hired somebody once I was a year in. So when I was a year in, I hired a PA. Technically they hired the PA, but I was busy enough, you know, certainly to justify having a PA. So then I worked with a PA for my second year, and that was very helpful. But it was just the two of us then.
So then after that 2 years, you joined your current practice.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And what's the name of your division of it?
Yeah, so my division is Chester County Orthopedics. I mean, we did get absorbed by a bigger group called Premier Orthopedics about 10 years ago, or we joined a bigger group, I should say. But the group I joined in 2006 was Chester County Orthopedics. Having been here in Westchester, Pennsylvania, the group was probably, I joined in 2006, they were already well established for probably 20 years prior to that. They were, you know, just a community. Again, it was probably 5. I was number 5 when I joined, but I was replacing somebody. So it had grown from 3. It started out with 3 guys back in the day and then grew to 5. And then one of the guys was leaving to go out to California to join some buddies. So then I came in and replaced him. So we were at 5 for a while. And then we're up to, I mean, my division remains at 9 right now, but we're part of a much bigger group.
Yeah. I think you said you have like 95.
So there's around 90 docs total in the, yeah, in the group that I'm in presently. I mean, what it's turned into, what it's evolved into.
Think about like where it started to like where it is now. I mean, I think for both of you, like my question is, you know, again, just something the other day that resonated with me, something that you posted, I think, one of our first guests, Dr. Paul,
yeah,
you know, he had said something and, you know, that I can't remember what the exact, you know, quote was, but you know, the rich doctor kind of persona that people have. Right. And I'm just listening to you tell this story of like, I mean, that sounded real glamorous. Like your first gig, it's like, I've got this little office. I've got no help. I've got no support. I'm doing call all by myself. It's just like,
yeah,
that sounds miserable. Like there's nothing glamorous about that whatsoever. And, you know, and I know some of your experiences too, like when you first kind of get out of school and you start practice, it's like, it's not an easy journey to get to a place where, you know, you are now. And then just having people constantly nag you every day, just like, fix me, fix me, fix me. And it's just like, there's that sense of entitlement over the last, you know, decade plus in healthcare that it's like, I can see the frustration for physicians, like, especially in the group that, you know, have sort of created with Red Carpet and, you know, the network that we found on LinkedIn and, you know, nationally, but it's like, I get it, right? I don't know. Just, I mean, from your perspective, I mean, can you just kind of like, I don't know, maybe just reflect on that a little bit, sort of like
20 years of medicine, yeah, how it's changed from when you started to now.
Yeah, it wasn't easy and it was passion and something you worked real hard to do. And now it's sort of just like, no, you need to do this for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an evolution for sure. And I can't tell you the number of times in a week that I now say, I wish we could go back to Chester County Orthopedics. That was my sweet spot. That was the best time of my life, was about the maybe 6 to 8 years that I was part of that group when we were just us. So my initial time with the hospital when I was employed was not all bad. It made me strong. I had to do what came through the door, you know, by and large. And again, I mean, small, you know, ER, like, I mean, I was doing hip fractures, which is what I do now on call too. But then I was doing more of like wrist fractures and ankle fractures. I don't do that so much anymore because we have a hand guy and a foot and ankle guy. But it made me strong. I was on an island. If I had an issue, I really had to just figure it out. I mean, when I started doing my arthroscopic shoulders there, the only person who knew what I was doing in the room was my arthrex rep. I mean, pretty much everybody else, because the guy before me wasn't a sports guy. He was more of a joint guy. And so he might have done a little bit of arthroscopy, but wasn't doing the stuff I was doing. So it was a great education. There were some tough times for sure, but overall, I think it definitely made me stronger. Then when I moved into my practice, it was actually a little bit hard right at first because it was a bigger hospital. It was busier. It was 40 minutes away from where I lived. My kids were still very young. And I was like, for the first week or two that I was there, I was like, ooh, what did I do? You know, I knew I made the right move because it was going to be better for my future. Great hospital, much better reputation, great group, great reputation, ability to grow, ability to do sports and not be so worried about doing more like general that I was sort of doing at the other hospital. And in the beginning, it was just also always a little bit on a little thing that we carry as women in orthopedics. They had never had a woman an orthopedist in the group or the hospital. They had some really seasoned OR nurses who were not nice to me at first, who saw this young female coming in wanting to do some things differently. So my first, you know, few weeks at the hospital, not so much in my practice, were a little bit rough. And then I broke people down and things got better over time, for sure. But my practice itself was a family. All my partners are great, even though, again, I was the first woman that most of them had worked with, but they were very supportive. I mean, they all, knew my background, knew where I came from, and were really, really good to me. And they said to me too, like, if you need to come in later on this day or leave early here, or you want to arrange your schedule so that you have more time for your kids, or you can take them to school or this or that, they were very like receptive to that. We were busy enough. We We made enough money. The practice was successful. We had employees that had been there for 10, 15, 20 years. It was just a beautiful place to work. Patients were, you know, had been in the practice. A lot of them, they developed a great reputation. So patients had been there for a long time. They were very, you know, welcoming to me too, patients from the doctor who had left. So it was a great time. Fast forward maybe 10 years from when I started is when we joined our bigger group, Premier. It was a little bit of a tough transition at first, but it was like these sort of like mega groups were being built around that time to help with, you know, having some power against insurance companies, better reimbursements, ancillary services, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was a little bit of a rough transition at first, but then it was also over time, you know, it got better and we, you know, actually just, we were still able to kind of run as our own division, which I think is what we liked about it. So, you know, at first we were able to be Chester County Orthopedics in the small print, a division of Premier. Over time, it more became Premier in the large print, Chester County division. But we were okay with it because things still, you know, ran pretty well and there was, you know, some benefit from it. And we were really still able to do our day to day, much like we always had.
And then when did the private equity acquisition occur? How many years ago was that?
2.5 years ago.
Two and a half.
So, yeah. So 2.5 years ago, we went into a whole new ballpark. And I think now is the time where, you know, I know there's many variations of these types of deals that happen. Ours has not been so smooth and easy. So this is what has me every day saying, I wish I could go back to Chester County Orthopedics, because it really is to the point now where we just feel like we are kind of hamsters on the wheel, which I think I've always felt that to some degree, you know, throughout my whole career, because it's a lot of the way we are as physicians and surgeons, and we're just busy all the time taking care of people, long hours, but it's just what we do. It's what we've always done, and better or worse, you know, we kind of are trained to do that. But when you're doing that for less and less reward, compensation, feeling less and less value, feeling like people who are making decisions for you don't really understand what you do on a day-to-day basis, you start to resent that and you start to become a little bit bitter about it. And, you know, again, I'm lucky to still work with a lot of the same people. I mean, my partners, my immediate partners, and we try to band together and like stay strong and keep doing our job and take care of the patients, but it's definitely getting harder.
Well, I can echo everything that you've just said. I haven't quite experienced all the different forms of practice that you have. I mean, you're hospital employed. You were kind of a smaller private practice than more of a large super group private practice, now private equity. Yep. I had the hospital employment deal for a couple of years, and it was miserable. I hated going in, being called into some administrator's office and being told, you're losing us money. I'm like, I'm doing 300 joints a year for you at that point, which was 3 years into my career. I'm like, I'm not stupid. I'm not losing you guys any money. But it's the same playbook that they all read out of.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, you know, the physicians, we've never really been taught business, and we've been taken advantage of for a very long period of time where people, especially administrators and insurance companies and now hospitals, they, you know, try to tell us that the patients are theirs and we're essentially commodities, replaceable. And that's fine if they want to believe that. But at the end of the day, they didn't go to medical school. They didn't go to residency. They didn't do fellowship. Right. They're not the ones in the ER, you know, setting. And I don't take ER call anymore, but they're not the ones washing out infected total joints. They're not the ones having those difficult conversations with patients. They're not the ones taking the calls in the middle of the night and getting sued potentially, right? It's like we have all the risk and our reward or compensation continues to go down for the past 20 years. It's super frustrating. This is... Again, one of the main reasons why we started this is I've seen, and you've seen, this pendulum swing from private practice to hospital employment or private equity employment. And I so yearn to help bring that pendulum back. Yep. And it'll never be all private practice, and I don't think it should be, right?
Right.
Not the right thing for everybody, but there needs to be some balance. And now, it is absolute chaos. There's a crisis that I don't think that a lot of patients even have any clue that there's a crisis. They think that physicians make millions and millions and millions of dollars. They think that we're like professional athletes, right? Yeah. Signing multi-million dollar contracts every year. They don't know the reality.
Right. Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, 100%. I mean, that's exactly my thoughts, like every day. And it's just, you know, increasingly frustrating. I used to, you know, wake up and be excited to go to work. Like, what's my, you know, what are my cases today? Or even patients. I mean, you always look at your list and you're like, you might see a couple names. You're like, oh, you know, that don't always make you so happy or whatever. But like, by and large, even a day where I've got a couple of like, either, you know, just like problem patients or whatever, even the office, which of course for most surgeons, the OR is the place we want to be, but even the office can be, you know, it can be fine and even fun and like having conversations with people, you know, of course we're going to talk about your knee pain, your shoulder pain or whatever, but also now having been in the same community for 20 years, you know, I've taken care of families. I've taken care of people. People remember more about me and like my kids and stuff than I can, you know, then it always surprises me still, you know? So people, especially that have been my patients for a while, they want to come in. They want to say, how are your kids? What's that? You know, they remember things. They remember that my daughter went to Emerson or this or that, you know, and I'm like, wow, you know, sometimes it surprises me what people remember and they just want to talk a bit. And so do I, but now, I mean, I was always busy and always saw a lot of patients, but now it's also like, if you're not seeing, you know, 30 patients or 32 patients or whatever, like, you know, that's not enough. You're not meeting your metrics, your numbers. If you're not doing this or that, you know, and who's deciding that, you know, is our like bosses now. And then you don't have the, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm like thinking in my mind, I'm chatting still, I'm doing what I want to do with my patients for the most part, but I'm thinking now I'm behind, now I'm more behind. And I didn't used to feel that way before. And then I'm thinking, all right, now I just got to do all these charts when I get home tonight, instead of trying to be somewhat caught up through the day. And when you're already working from 7:30 to 4:30 or 5, and then, you know, at least, you know, at least for me, because I tend to want to talk to my patients and do things, I come home and I have potentially facing another couple hours of work at home, or then if you're on call or whatever, that is what I think people don't understand, you know, that you're working a full day and then you're coming home and working more, at least I am many nights. You know, so, and we don't have scribes. We run fairly lean in our practice, always had. We have little clinical teams of a doc, a PA, and an MA. And right now I have an amazing PA. I mean, I always have. We have an amazing staff of PAs in our group. I have an amazing MA right now. But even still, you know, that's a good amount of help, but it's not enough that, you know, I don't come home and still have work to do. So
the million-dollar question I have, and this is what this podcast was created to do, is like to help create solutions, because we can talk till we're blue in the face about the problems. But what do you think are some potential solutions to help with the healthcare crisis? Because physicians are getting burned out at alarming rates. Physicians are committing suicide at alarming rates. Orthopedic surgeons, unfortunately, take the number one spot of physician suicide at 28.2%. And people are leaving medicine. No one wants to go into it anymore. And docs are leaving quicker than they're coming in. We're going to have a huge shortage here of physicians and orthopedic surgeons in particular. Yeah. What's the solution from your standpoint?
You know, that's the thing. I mean, it is the million-dollar question for sure. And I wish I knew. I mean, I don't know how we take back control. I mean, like in some way, shape, or form, physicians need to be able to be in control again of how they treat their patients and how they are treated. So, I mean, I wish I had the answer. And it's part of why I've also like started now to just kind of be a little bit more on a crusade myself to try to find it out, or get with like-minded people who are working to find it out. I mean, I think there's no way that we can continue like this. And it's very hard for me to, you know, talk to anybody, any young person. I mean, neither one of my daughters were interested in medicine, but if they were, I would have I would have 100% tried to talk them out of it, you know, and that's very sad. And I mean, I've never been in a teaching institution, but even through private practice, I've had like, you know, kids, friends or people who, you know, say, well, can my kids shadow? They're in college or they're in this or that, you know, and they're interested in it. And I've certainly done a good amount of that, or even kids. I did similar things to that what my mentor did for me. Like I've, you know, taken care of some of the kids from the same college that I went to and tried to like mentor them, but it's much harder to do now. You don't want it. Not encourage the bright and interested kids to go into it, because you know we need that for our future. Yet it's hard for me to like, you know, say, yeah, you know, this is the greatest profession ever, just the way we're being treated right now. So again, I wish I had something more concrete to tell you, but I mean, I can tell you from my standpoint of it is there's got to be a way to open up the eyes and get rid of this extensive corporate influence that's here. I mean, we are not a business like any other. I mean, that's always like the platform I'm on. I'm like, you cannot treat healthcare like any other business. And I'm always like, just it baffles my mind to think like if the CEO of whatever company it is, that's a private equity company or an insurance company, if they're sick or they're ill and they're in your OR, are they going to want to like be, you know, dealing with, oh, the surgeon's, you know, this is her 10th case for the day. This is, you know, they don't want to understand that like we're potentially tired. Like, you know, we don't have the staff or the equipment even or things that we need all the time. And I think if it was, you know, them or their family member in that position as the patient, they'd have a much different viewpoint than they do now. I don't know. I always think that they should just be in the OR with us side by side, like one day, you know, see what we actually do.
I mean, it's a team effort, right? Like there's no doubt about it. Like the administrators, the nurses, the this, the that. And I'm kind of preempting my statement here, but the way I feel when you're mentioning this about the CEOs, because this is how I felt, is like if the CEO is sick and doesn't show up to work, guess what? Yeah. My 6 cases still get done. Right. If the anesthesiologist doesn't show up, guess what? They send in another one or a CRNA comes in. If the nurse doesn't come in or my PA doesn't come in, and this is not demeaning to any of these people because they are critical people for this team process to work. But if you know, John Doe comes in to get his knee replacement and this person and 5 or other people come in to get their hip or knee replacement done and I don't show up.
Yep.
He doesn't have surgery.
Nothing happens. Yeah. The show's not happening.
Yep, exactly.
So why are we the people that are, and again, I'm not trying to play the victim here, but we're the ones taking the hits.
Yep.
Day in and day out. It's like, and maybe because we've just allowed it to happen. So is Daniel Paul correct? I mean, do we need to go to direct care models?
I think kind of for me, what's coming up is like, I think the reality is, and I think we could all agree, and it's been a theme of a lot of these conversations that we've had, is like medicine and healthcare in general has become very commoditized.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's insurance companies, it's health systems and insurance companies being under one umbrella, which seems kind of weird. You know, there's all these things that it's like, okay, well, and obviously the techniques, the training, all, of, you know, in just terms of medicine, it's gotten, you know, better. In, you know, going back 20 years, but just in terms of like, okay, like how does a practice function? How do you do this? How do you do that? I mean, I remember a long time ago when like every primary care doctor was like, that was their own little business. Like that's what they did. They had 2 or 3, you know, partners. And now it's like, you don't know any primary care doctor that's not owned by a health system. And then very conveniently, those health systems that also control the insurance plans also want to absorb the specialists. And it's like, well, how do you start to see the structure, right? It's like, you know, it's like supply and demand. It's like Y and B. And it's like the same thing with other businesses. And, you know, Doc, to your point, it's like, I agree with you 100%. I don't think that healthcare can be run like any other business. And they have figured out a way to do it.
Yeah.
And it's just not working. And it's not good because the people that they rely on a daily basis, the providers, they're getting burnt out. I mean, and this is just not unique to this conversation because I come across the different physicians in my world every day, not just Dr. Molly. And this is a common theme. I mean, this is not anything that's unique to you or, you know, to Dr. Molly. I mean, I'm seeing it every single day and they're burnt out because they've got a thumb on them and they're pressing them. And exactly kind of what you're saying. It's like, you need to see this many people, you know, you're losing money in clinic, you know, RVU, let's talk about the contracts, this and that. It's just like, okay, I need to practice good medicine to have good outcomes so that people want to come here. Right. Yeah. Well, what if we could just make them come to you no matter what? And for me, that's just like, that's the commodity business side of it. And it's just like, what are we going to do when all of these providers are like, you know what? I'm good. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm not going to do it
it's
anymore.
Getting there.
And some of a lot of you surgeon providers but don't need to do it anymore. You know, you're getting to the point where it's like we are entrepreneurial mindset. I can go and, you know, I'm excited actually to chat with you about another endeavor that I've seen that you're doing on LinkedIn and, you know, a group that you've pieced together, like that sort of stuff. It's like I don't need to do this anymore, right? I mean, social media, the capability, like the platforms that have been created now, you don't have to do it anymore. And it's like, to me, we're getting to a scary, scary place where the reality is, you know, the quality of what you're going to see, and it, that's happened in, you know, other areas and other businesses that I would hate to compare it to healthcare, but it's like they almost kind of, you know, force you to, you know, and it's like, I'm with you, and I'm optimistic. And as my good buddy over here always says, where there's a problem, there's a solution.
Yep.
I just feel like this is too far gone, and the machine is too big, and the train is moving all over the country in this direction. And it's like, you know, and these maybe subspecialties in small rural areas where maybe they just don't care to go out and get, like, I don't know what can be done to overcome that and to provide, you know, the physician with, you know, more input. It's like, I think to your point and, you know, sort of what you were saying is like, we're being told what to do and how to manage our day by somebody who has no clue what we do. That never works. And it's just, you know, it's insane to me that we just, this is the path that it just continues to go down. And it just seems like it's never going to change.
Boy.
Yeah, there's too many people that are getting hurt here. The patients, because their premiums go up every year, their networks get narrower, their deductibles go up every year, and then the physicians, the reimbursements go down, while hospital executives and insurance company executives, it's they're flying around on their corporate jets, sitting up in their boardroom suites.
Right.
And, you know, I'm private practice, so I can say whatever I want about that kind of stuff. But,
well, I know. I mean, I agree with you, you know, again, 10,000%. And, you know, it is just, it's just maddening. And, you know, if you look at my group, I'm the second most senior. So I'm 53. I've been in practice again for 20 years. And I feel terrible for our younger partners. I mean, I feel, you know, kind of bad for myself some days on any given day. Like, our situation is not the best right now. And it's not where I thought I would be at 20 years in practice. It's, I have been for a few years now, even before our situation got a little bit worse, you know, kind of looking for a way out, looking for my next step. I was getting a little bit burnt out of just doing what I do. I think probably anything can get a little stale at times. And then I was thinking, maybe, you know, I'm not going to want to do this for 10 more years or so. But then you get in the OR and I start doing the cases that I like to do, and start doing, and I'm like, and then you think, but this is fun and we're helping people. And like, I've been, you know, perfecting my skills for all these years. I have a certain skill set that, you know, not many people have in the grand scheme of things. And it's an important one. And so that's what always just is always like a stake through my heart. And those of like the partners and everybody I work with and other people that I'm meeting who are physicians. And we all know how hard we trained, how hard we work to get where we are. And every single one of my partners, as we walk around all day, miserable now, to varying degrees of being miserable. We still, you know, again, be happy, you know, to see a patient who's done well, to do, you know, work with a friend, do a great case. But, you know, it really has changed the climate so much. And it's just so sad. And we used to have a little bit more time. We used to do, like, I used to be like the party planner for my group, and we did fun things and we went out, and it's just, no, everybody's too tired. Or at the end of the day, they don't have time, or they're rushing here and there. And like, I feel like that's just part of what's made it worse. And then again, we're out, we don't have control. We're, you know, working harder for less. And it's just, it's a recipe for disaster. And I will tell you, I mean, again, I thought now I would practice, of course, at least another 8 to 10 years, but I don't think there's any way I can do that in this climate at all.
Yeah. So that kind of segues into a great little fun, your med school roommate, Dr. Amy Breen, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Towson had given her med school roommate a shout out. A couple months back, she was maybe still is, and that's my question to you. Yeah. ER doctor out in California, and was 40, and was just at this point, just like burned out. And she didn't go into it in her. She wrote a book, essentially. Yeah. That's what I'm getting to. Tranquila, a doctor mom. Oh, I saw that. Explores a simple life in Spain or something.
Life in Spain. Yeah.
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 So got the audiobook, listened to it. I flew through it in about maybe a week and a half. It was really well done.
Yeah.
Kind of her journey out of the US over there with three young kids and her husband and lived in Barcelona and stuff I didn't even know. Like they don't speak Spanish there. They speak Catalonia.
Yeah.
I'm like, isn't what?
Yeah, it's a different dialect, different language entirely, really, you know, in Barcelona. Yeah.
Didn't have a car. She's walking her kids. She's taking trains and walking and this and that and doing the reverse, coming home after dropping them off at school and getting them into soccer. And you think kids sports are intense here, but like her description of it there was just what is she doing now? Because she took a 2-year hiatus. Is she back in medicine?
She never went back to practicing medicine, no.
Wow.
No, she does some consulting work and, you know, so we had been very close in med school and then we did lose touch for a little while. She moved out to California. And so that's where she still lives now. So then we had been like just a little bit in touch. And then more recently, her, her oldest son now goes to Haverford College where I went. Yeah. And so then we sort of got reconnected
did
again.
Did she go to Haverford?
No. She went to the University of Virginia.
Okay.
But she was from like the Pennsylvania, or the like area near where Haverford College was, is where she was originally from. And then our med school was not far from there either. So, but she was also a lacrosse player. So that was like another connection that we had. And then we were med school roommates.
Where'd you go to med school?
To Medical College of Pennsylvania, which is now Drexel.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So, she moved out to California and, we lost touch for a while and then recently again, like I said, reconnected. So, and
you're
then
Hahnemann, right?
What's that?
Were you at Hahnemann?
So while I was at MCP, it merged with Hahnemann. So okay.
I thought there was some connection because did Drexel buy Hahnemann then?
Yeah. So, yeah. So I went to, I was the actually last class to graduate from MCP.
Okay.
So diploma is kind of like an antique or a relic or whatever, because it's the last class that was from the school before it merged. While I was there, they merged with Hahnemann. And then it was MCP Hahnemann was the name for a long time. And then I don't know when Drexel came into the picture. I mean, I was long gone, but you know, it's been Drexel for a while. So, but while I was there, MCP Hospital still existed, but it was going downhill. So MCP Hospital closed. We could do rotations at Hahnemann or we could do rotations at Allegheny General out in Pittsburgh, was also affiliated with the school. So that's where I did all my clinical rotations. So I lived in Pittsburgh for 2 years doing my clinical rotations and ended up doing my residency there. So that's why I was there for 7 years.
Got it.
And Amy and I, again, kind of more recently reconnected and she was just completely burnt out. Like she describes, you know, some in not great detail, but certainly some in the book. And so more recently, she's been doing just some consulting work. She wrote the book. I'm not sure how long it took her to actually write that. And then she's like, you know, in part like a stay-at-home mom, too. She's got younger kids. Like her oldest is a sophomore in college, and then the other two are younger. So.
Okay, because they were like during the book.
They were pretty young, yeah. Like when they went to Barcelona,
10, 8, and 6 or something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so it was.
Does she regret not coming back to medicine at all? Not at all.
Not at all.
And was her burnout, because again, she didn't go into tremendous detail. Was it more like the clinical stuff? Because she was ER, right?
Yeah.
Which is like it takes a special breed to do that. Yeah. Or was it everything? Yeah.
I think it was a little bit of everything. I think it was the working mom aspect of it and like, you know, kind of, you know, that finding that balance that she found like difficult to do. And then a little bit like, I think the clinicals, I think it didn't end up being like what she thought it would be. I haven't asked her if she thought maybe she would have been better in a different specialty or something like that. But I think she just didn't really enjoy it the way she thought she would.
Yeah.
Have you been into an ER lately?
I avoid ERs.
Same.
So much. Man, I got to tell you, I had a incident where I had to help one of my very good friends and I had to take his dad there because he had to be admitted because of an issue that he had. And it was more of a hospital, you know, bed thing where it was like, oh, well, if you go to the ER, they'll get you in. But another story. But I mean, I'm looking around there and there has to be 35 people sitting in the ER. And I would say 75 to 80% of them are kind of just chatting and laughing. And I'm like, there's nothing emergent about any of the reasons these people can be here. Because I mean, seriously, I'm like, what the hell is going on in here? Like, this is wild. And a friend of mine at the ER where I was, she has a lot of influence there from an admin perspective. And I shot her a message and I'm like, is it always like this in here? I feel like none of these people like are in urgent need of medical care. Like this could be done probably in an outpatient like sort of scenario. And she's like, no, it's like, this is like this every single day. That probably had something to do with it. I don't know if California's any different. I don't think it is, but I was, I mean, obviously thank, you know, a lot that I haven't had to go to one lately, but I was shocked at just the people just sort of sitting around in there, just thinking to myself, like, can you imagine the conversations that they're having?
Oh my.
On a, like, seriously, on a daily basis and coming in to have these conversations with these people. And it's just like, no, there's nothing wrong. And no, I'm not going to give you that. Go home.
Yeah. Crazy.
So I have two more fun things that I want to talk about. Okay. One is your other passion, which is ballroom dancing.
Yes.
And it sounds like you get to make it. Is it always Italy?
Yeah, I mean, it's Italy where I go because my teacher, who is my, you know, also dance partner in competition, lives in Italy. So whenever I'm traveling to dance, it's to Italy, at least for part of the time. And then
it's horrible.
I know. so it's and then from a competition standpoint, we're usually competing, if not in Italy, someplace in Europe. So it really has also this has completely changed my life. And it really kind of does balance things out a little bit for me because I do have this, you know, this passion, something I really enjoy and get to do, you know, maybe would love to do it even more than I get to do it, but it does help when I'm at a point where I'm kind of at my breaking point with work. If I've got a dance trip coming up, it definitely helps, gives me something to look forward to. But yeah, it ended up being this international kind of long distance thing, long story behind it, but it's a lot of fun.
What part of Italy do you go to for like your training and stuff?
My dance teacher, whose name is Roberto, is originally from like the Tuscany area. So he lives in a small town in Tuscany called Cecina. So that's where I go. And, usually when we're doing, I do like a dance trip, I'm there for maybe a week or 10 days if I can spare it. And we spend days just training in the dance studio where he is there, where he grew up dancing since he was like 10 years old. And then we do usually kind of arrange the trip so that we can do a competition while I'm there. And, again, sometimes we travel outside of Italy to do the competitions as well. So
love Tuscany. That's actually where my family's from.
Okay. So oh, very cool.
Years ago, in October 2022, uh-huh. We took a huge trip. I took my parents. My parents have never been out of the country, not even to Canada. Mm-hmm. And so we got to see like where my grandfather grew up, the house he grew up in.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
We got to see my great grandfather's uh-huh. tomb. They're from the Tuscany region. They're a small town called Torsana, which is on the top of a mountain. It's near a bigger town, but it's very tiny, called Caparagana.
Okay.
And the Italian culture is amazing. Like, there is no doubt that at some point in my life, I'm going to have like in Italy, maybe dual citizenship.
Yeah.
So,
No, it's been amazing. And it's, like I said, it's such a great outlet. I started taking lessons initially just for something kind of fun to do because I've always enjoyed watch Dancing with the Stars, stuff like that. And then I had no idea that you could actually do what I do now. I didn't know there was such a thing as pro-am competitions where you have, you know, the teacher student dancing together. And when I learned of it, I'm like, I could see myself doing that. And then, you know, my teacher was here in the U.S. at first. He was here working in a studio that's not far from where I live and work. And I just went for some like casual lessons. And then it kind of grew from there. And he was here on a work visa. And then that was 2018, 2019. And then COVID came. And so then he went back to Italy and stayed. And we had talked about the possibility of, you know, trying to continue, you know, even if he wasn't going to stay beyond his work visa, regardless of the pandemic. And we worked it out. It's a little bit non-traditional. I take lessons here on Zoom with him 3 days a week. And then I try to go 4 times a year. We try to compete 4 or 5 times a year. We do like a week in person again of like 6 hours in the studio and then do each day and then do a competition. And
how are you doing? It's not like you dancing by yourself. You have a partner. Are you using like
or something?
A stand-in, or I'm thinking like the virtual reality or something like
that? No, no, it's hard to conceptualize at first, and we didn't know how it was going to work at first, but I actually just dance by myself. I actually use the waiting room of one of my offices. Our biggest office is my dance studio at night and on the weekends. Because I really didn't have any other space, and I tried like renting a space in a studio, but it just wasn't very easy to do. So two nights a week, I go to my office, move all the chairs out of the waiting room. It takes me 12 minutes to do it. I've timed it. I move them all out. We have a pretty decent space. We have a coat rack that's like perfectly positioned that I can put my computer there, and it's up high so he can see into the whole room. And it's 5:30 is usually the earliest I can do it here based on when we're done working.
It's 11:30 for him.
So, exactly. So wow, we do a 2-hour, yeah, we do a 2-hour lesson for, so it's 11:30 to 1:30 AM for him.
Yeah.
And I dance by myself. And I'm actually able to go through our routines, and you know, certain steps and things are easier because they are meant to be do together. So for balance or whatnot, but a lot of it, it's maybe a much stronger dancer because I can't follow. I have to be able to know the directions of my steps. I have to develop my own balance better. I have to, like, you know, do it, you know, quote unquote, by myself. And it was hard at first, but now it's how we do it. And it's,
so I guess,
actually,
when you're together,
yeah,
mm-hmm. Do you lead? Does he lead?
Oh, no, he does. He still does. But when we're together, you know, I can be a better partner. Like, and I actually feel a little bit more like a partner as compared to a student now. Part of it's because I've been dancing now, also, I mean, improved my level and whatnot. We've been doing this for going on 7 years total of dancing together. But it makes me a much better follower and a better partner if I actually, you know, understand better the direction of the step or what he's doing and what I'm supposed to do in response, you know, rather than just him dragging me around, so to speak. You know?
And is it like Dancing with the Stars? Do they give you like a certain, do you need to know different dances? Like, we're doing the tango this week, we're doing the cha-cha. Yeah. Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So, I mean, it could be a very in-depth, explanation. And I learned a lot in this world that I had no idea existed, but there's different styles and there's all these different dances, and there's an international style and an American style. And so we dance total 14 different dances. So I know 14. So it's like tango, waltz, foxtrot, all the things you were mentioning. So there's 14 of them that we do. And then basically
bachata? What do you got?
Yeah, we do. That's a nightclub dance, but we do that sometimes too for fun. But we do 14 of the ballroom dances, and then you you choreograph. He choreographs, not me. Choreographs like a minute and a half of choreography, and then when you're in competition, it works with any song. Like, so any cha-cha song, because of the timing and the beats per minute and whatever, we do our choreography, and it doesn't matter what song they play. So, you know, that's how it works in competition. So,
can you do some dancing for us?
No. Maybe next time.
Hey, I have to tell you, like, I'm a big Cleveland Cavaliers fan.
Uh-huh.
So when Iman Shumpert was on Dancing with the Stars,
yeah,
I like watched religiously.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, mm-hmm. I had zero expectations when I'm like, okay, yeah, you know, I mean, Shumpert's my guy, so I'm gonna watch.
Yeah.
The athleticism in the movements, in the timing of these dances, I was like,
yeah,
holy crap.
Mm-hmm.
It seriously is insane. Have you ever watched it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm like, they're in the air, and they're like, and then just the theming and like the different styles of dance.
Yeah.
It's just, it's nuts. So kudos to you, because I can, like, I just started remembering my social security number a couple of years ago, so I don't know. You remember some of those routines.
What type of dance would you do to this?
Two style.
Yeah. The two steps.
There's a little, mm-hmm. not even an inside thing here, because that's Barry, right?
Yeah.
So,
have you listened to anything off the new album? Have you seen Time as a Playground?
I have not. I need to download it.
You need to, because it's actually, I'm a very like harsh critic, because I, you know, there's some of the newer stuff that's come out over the past, let's say, 5 years. I've liked a few songs here and there, not as much of some of the older stuff, but this one, this is a good one. Yeah, I really am liking this new one.
So for all the people out there that are like, what is going on right now?
Yeah, exactly. We're talking about
cha-cha.
I'm one of those guys.
So he's my co-host is like, what's going on? So yeah. Dr. Towson had some type of post, and it was a shout out to this, I would say, not a no-name band, but a very well-known band.
Yeah.
But an amazing band.
Oh, for
name is Carbon Leaf.
Yep.
Shout out Carbon Leaf.
So, yes. So Jared, who's coming into town so Jared is my best childhood friend. Travis is my best adulthood friend.
Got it.
Jared and I were best men in each other's.
Adult is a relative term, but
we behave like children a lot. But Jared was the best man at my wedding. I was the best man in his wedding. Uh-huh. He's coming into town Friday. We're planning a golf outing. And Jared introduced me to Carbon Leaf back in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And he got married in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Was it one or? Yeah, it was early 2000s. And we ended up going to Myrtle Beach, knowing that Carbon Leaf was going to play down there. Mm-hmm. And I was going to wear it for this.
Oh, that would have been good.
I'll have the t-shirt. I'll take a photo of it so that Jay can put it in here.
I want Carbon Leaf. We need a SoundCloud. What's your guys' favorite song? We need a link right here
for
the viewers.
We'll do it. But I had this Kelly green t-shirt made with Jared's face on it, Myrtle Beach, and then on the back, 33 things. You know, it was kind of like this Rolling Rock tribute, but it was all Jared things. And so we wore these t-shirts to the Carbon Leaf concert. And Jared had seen them many times. I'd seen them maybe three or four times at that point. And we were screaming, just the drunk bachelors here. We're screaming to Barry. We threw a shirt up there, one of them. And we're like, put shirt on. And he wouldn't put it on until the very last song. And he finally.
Oh, really? Oh, that's fantastic.
So, yeah. Tired of these idiots yelling at us.
But Adrian has become very good friends with this band.
Yeah.
He's seen them 99 times.
99. Right? Yeah. 100th is coming up in December.
Mm-hmm. Where at?
So they play at the world in Philly, a place called the World Cafe Live.
December what?
December 6th. You'll come?
I was going to tell you, it could be your 100th time. It could be my first time.
What day is that?
There you go. So they play there pretty much every year, like the first weekend in December. It's kind of the start of their, like what they call kind of like the last leg of their tour for the year, usually like the holiday.
I got to tell you, although I hate flying in and out of Philly, I mean, that's the easiest flight ever from
December 6th is a Friday. December
6th. It's a Friday night.
We could leave right after clinic.
I have clinic. Maybe we could.
Yeah, we could just leave right after clinic.
Which is on Thursday.
You will be my guest in my private party on the mezzanine that I have done there for, this will be the 13th and final year that I'm doing it. I'm putting it together with my 100th show and just kind of making it like the grand finale here. But it's been a really cool experience with this band. I actually was turned on to the band by one of my co-residents from my time at Allegheny General, a guy who was like 4 years ahead of me, who's currently an orthopedic oncologist in Dallas, Texas. Once we were already gone from residency, I'm pretty close to all the guys I trained with because there was only two of us a year at that time. So for the like five of the guys that were like chiefs when I started and then all the way through and a couple years behind me, we're all stayed pretty close. We're all scattered, but it was, definitely, as you well know, a bonding experience. And when there's only two of us a year, we were pretty, pretty well bonded. But anyway, and he would just tell me every now and then, you gotta listen to this band. We had some similar tastes in music. So this was back like 2005, 2006. I started really like following them. And it was just one of the bands that he gave me. He's like, you got to listen to this band, Carbon Leaf. So back then it was like, I bought a CD, it was Indian Summer. It was my first CD that I bought. And I listened to it. I put it in the car, listened to it. And it was one of those ones where, again, I didn't skip any songs. I was like, these are all great. Like, I really love this band. And then I bought my next CD. And then next thing you know, like probably 2006, it was probably 2007 was the first time I ever saw them live. And the first place I ever saw them live was World Cafe Live in Philly. And I had never been to a smaller venue like that. I mean, I'd been to other bigger concerts, but I'd never been to some place where you could actually like be up close, be at the stage if you want to be, whatever. And I was amazed at how good they sounded, in person, same as on the recording, maybe better. And then fast forward, I was like, this is, you know, I really like this band. We're going to see where they tour. And they tour a lot on the East Coast, so it's easy to go to. I have actually flown to see them a few times. And then my mom came with me. And then my kids were still young at that time. But when there was an all-ages venue, my kids would come. And then we just, it became our thing. And then two or three shows in, they always come out to their merch table after. So I went up and, you know, was talking to them. And little by little, just developed a friendship. And fast forward 10 years later, and they've played at my house 3 times total. And then I started doing these parties at World Cafe Live, became friends with them. They've watched my kids grow up. I mean, it's
just. Are your daughters fans?
They are. Yeah, they are. When they were young, they were like, mommy just brainwashed us, you know, because when we'd go to the shows, my kids would be singing there, all, you know, singing all the lyrics to all the songs. They knew the songs because it was all they would listen to. Anytime I was in the car, I was playing it, you know, and they had their favorite songs. And a couple people would come up to me sometimes because there weren't a lot of kids at their shows, even the all ages shows. You know, there's not too many kids that go. And they'd be like, are you related to the band? Like, no, but we're watching they're related to the band. They sing, they know all the words. And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, we listen to them a lot, but we're not related to them. I'm like, we're friends with them now. I said, but it was funny. So, and then again, like over the time, they just, you know, we just got to know them more and more. And it's just been a really cool, before I started dancing, but now even condition or even together with dancing, it's like, it is one of my outlets. Like, you know, going to their shows would also be a thing. Like I would be known to like drive 3 hours to a show that was like somewhere, you know, whether it was a 3 hour driving distance, even on a night where I had to work the next day was not out of the question. You know? Wow. So that's
commitment right there.
Yeah.
And they are amazing. I mean, I just played a little snippet of one song, but like, they have a unique sound. I kind of Celtic rock-ish.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Number 6, Philly, watch out. Might have a Travis and a Molly near you.
We'll have to get an Oaks too. Jared will have to come out.
Oh, dude.
So I was telling him the story that you were going to be on our podcast.
Yeah.
And he's like, he reminded me of that story. He's like, did you tell her the put it on story? I'm like, what's the put it on story? He's like, remember you guys were trying to get him to put the t-shirt on and I was like, did they finally put it on? He's like, they eventually
did. I like Philly too. Do you know a little spot there called Monk's?
Mm-mm, no.
A buddy of mine.
Is that like a diner or something?
No. So, and again, I mean, in orthopedics, but just in general, like ER call or like hospital call, like the Vista collar, the cervical collar that's used for.
Yeah.
Okay. So that manufacturer, Aspen, fresh out of college, I worked for them for 10 years and literally traveled the country doing like trauma bracing and stuff. And one of my colleagues, who's a very good friend of mine, Justin Pepper, lives in Philly. Mm-hmm. And he is now like an international sales manager and for the same company and goes literally all over the globe, just doing this all over the place. And it was a place like his first sales manager and then whoever like came in next, there was this little hole in like a hole in the wall bar called Monk's. I'm sure I'm getting that right. It's Monk's in Philly. It's downtown. Like on a side road, you'd miss it if you were driving. I mean, you have to walk there because like you fall out. It's literally like, I mean, it's the door. It's a super tiny place, but they have like, I don't know, like 200 beer options or something. Like they have like the most vast array beer menu I've ever seen outside of Dr. Miller, Blake, when you're talking about Hopcat, that place in Grand Rapids. It's literally insane, but it's just a tiny little hole in the wall. And every time I'd go to Philly for like a conference or I'd go for a weekend and go to like a Phillies game or something like that, I would always go to Monk's. So. I'll take you there when we go in December.
You gotta let me know. Again, it's my favorite, one of my favorite nights of the year. And for my kids too. So my kids then went through like the teenage years where maybe it wasn't as cool to like mom's band so much, you know, but nonetheless they were into developing their own music taste. But then as they've now come to be adults, that show is always very important to them because when they started coming when they were like 13 and 15 maybe. So, and they were the only kids there and it was like mom's friends, mom's work friends who they knew, but like my kids were also like the little VIPs up in the mezzanine there and they would just love that night. So once they were in college, I mean, my kids both studied abroad and they both studied abroad fall semester. So they weren't home yet for the show, the years that they were abroad. But other than that, they've come back from college. It's been like, it's usually very close to Thanksgiving. My one daughter went to college in Boston. She flew home for Thanksgiving, went back. She flew home like 2 weeks later to go to World Cafe. Cafe Live. And my older daughter lives in Iowa now, and she was just texting with me yesterday. What's the date again? I need to take it off work, and we're flying in, her and her boyfriend. So it's a fun night.
What do your daughters do again?
So my older daughter is she's an event coordinator for Iowa State University. So she lives out in Ames, Iowa. She has been there for two years now, I think. She originally went because her boyfriend, who's her high school boyfriend, they've been together for 7 years, dating since they were 16. He took a job out there first. He works for the United States Department of Agriculture.
Okay.
So she went to school in Boston. She went to Emerson. She was not really too psyched about the Midwest at first, but they're not there permanently. And then they've been making the best of it. It's really kind of a cute town where they live, and they're probably there maybe one more year. Yeah. So she works at Iowa State. And my other daughter just graduated from NYU.
Is that in Des Moines, or where is that at?
Just outside of Des Moines. So it's probably about 35-minute drive to Des Moines.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So my daughter was a journalism major, and she went to Emerson in Boston. And when she first moved there, she was working for NBC, for the affiliate station there, as a news producer. She did that for the first year, but she was working the morning news. So her work hours were 3 a.m. to 12 noon. And
my gosh,
very conducive to a good lifestyle. And, you know, her and her boyfriend being out there without knowing anybody and trying to figure out how to navigate life, it wasn't the greatest, and not a lot of time off and so on and so forth. So she's super organized and likes to plan things, and also had an interest in event planning. So then she was able to change jobs after the first year, and she now works as an event coordinator for Iowa State, and she loves it. So much better quality of life.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So yeah. And my younger daughter just graduated from NYU in May, and so she is doing a photography internship. She's a budding photographer, so we'll see. She probably will end up back in New York, but we're not sure. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, very far from medicine. But like I said earlier, if either one of them had wanted to go into it, I mean, if it was truly their calling, let's say, I mean, if it's a calling for us, which I think it is for many of us, I would have certainly supported it. And, you know, of course we need good people, bright people going into it, but I was really kind of glad that they weren't interested in it, to be honest with you. You know, it would have been a hard conversation.
Yeah. I feel that. Boys, and
yeah,
two of the three have told me on multiple occasions that they want to be orthopedic surgeons like their dad. And
yeah,
I haven't, thankfully, been not watching these podcasts, but
yeah,
you know, as they get, they're very young, and maybe it's just that like I want to be like dad thing, but will have to be a real kind of Jesus talk if that,
For sure.
Not that I would dissuade it again, like you said. Yeah. Because I do believe medicine for most is a calling. And for me, I think it was for sure.
Yep.
But it's not what it used to be. And it's becoming much more challenging.
I've got a consultant on my hands at the age of 4. So.
Oh, really?
Well, if he takes after you, that's definitely what he's going to do.
I know where he gets that from. So, hey, so one thing I would be remiss not to bring up, but I just kind of came across that I just wanted to learn a little bit more about, you know, on your side of things is, so this, I don't know, network group, the Working Moms.
Oh, the Working Mom.
Yeah. I just like, I was reading a little bit about it, and I love that. So could you just tell us a little bit about like what that is?
Yeah. So that's kind of the brainchild and the baby of myself and my best friend. So my best friend, her name is Lisa, and we actually met through the hospital where we work. She's a PA and was working with the vascular surgeons in the hospital where I work. And we've been acquaintances for many years, and then probably about 9 years ago or so, kind of just started to, you know, go out and do some things, talk, and gradually just became really good friends, had a lot of things in common. And she has since left. She doesn't work at the hospital anymore. She does a home job where she's does like an appeal letters and insurance stuff. She actually works for United Healthcare. She left. and she doesn't enjoy it now. But she was, you know, a little bit undervalued in her position as a PA for many years, working for this vascular surgery group as the only PA with three surgeons. And it was a little bit tough covering three different hospitals and so on and so forth. She has one daughter, who's now 16. So when she made this decision, was younger, and she was, you know, feeling like she needed more time with her, so on and so forth. So anyway, made this change during that time. You know, we also thought maybe we could come up with something else to do at some point, you know, again, trying to put on our entrepreneur hat a little bit, trying to see like, what else could we do if we both eventually want to be out of medicine. And we, you know, came up with a lot of ideas that were not great and, you know, kind of just drank a bottle of wine, said, yeah, that one's not going to go anywhere. That one's not going to go anywhere, you know, whatever. And then
I'd love to see that list of ideas too.
This one's done. But anyway, so then we eventually said, okay, well, what else do we know? Because we said, do we have to do something like an offshoot of medicine? Like, what do we know? We know medicine. We know, I mean, you know, your vascular stuff, your GenSurg stuff. I know ortho, but like, what else can we do? What else do we know? Well, we're moms. We're working moms. We're single working moms. I mean, I've been single since my kids were 1 and 3. She's been in an very amicable situation with her ex-husband more recently, but still for many years has also been a single working mom. So we're like, maybe we can come up with some way to help other moms in healthcare and try to just, you know, develop some kind of a community platform, something that would support. You know, I've already now kind of been through it, so to speak. I mean, my kids are adults now. And she's kind of in the middle of it. So anyway, we decided let's write a blog. Let's do something about this. So we basically decided we'd start the company. We came up with a name, a logo. We've actually got the logo trademarked, and we're like, how are we gonna like develop this idea? So we started writing a blog. So we just started the website and blog 4 years ago. It's been very much a side thing because we're both so busy with our jobs and our kids and everything, but we've been trying to develop a way to deliver content and support to other working moms in healthcare to try to help manage all the difficulties that we face, that we know it's a very challenging thing, you know, to manage your time and feel like you're not, you know, get rid of the guilt feeling that you actually can do both. You know, people ask me all the time, patients and other people I come across, like, wow, how did you do it? Like, how did you raise, like, because not be a little biased, but I think my kids turned out pretty great. They're like, how did you do that? You know, working as much as you did. And first question or first answer is always, it's not without help. And I had a lot of help from my parents, but we wanted to potentially be, you know, that help or offer some strategies or offer guidance, you know, for especially younger working moms coming up through. So we have almost finished our first book. We decided that we're going to try to offer the content in the form of like a handbook series. So we have our blog available. We're doing that we add to. We used to add to it a little bit more frequently, but we're trying to still add to the blog. We do have some other presence on social media. And then we are almost done with the first in what will be a series of handbooks to try to cover a bunch of different topics that, you know, we think will hopefully be helpful and interesting to other moms that are looking for some guidance out there.
So
that's awesome.
So you both create that content, and then in terms of like publishing it, piecing it together, do you have like a partner that you work with to do that? Or I'm just curious what that looks like.
Yeah. So Lisa, my friend, has a friend who's a book publisher who helps people self-publish. And, you know, there's a couple different avenues we could go, you know, with him, but we're getting right into that, you know, kind of final stage now. So I'm not exactly sure how it's going to play out or how we're going to, you know, do it, but we're luckily have some connections here and there. So that's the plan. We just basically started our website. So we launched our website on Mother's Day of 2020. So COVID time. We just developed our LLC. We went through like LegalZoom and got all the documents we needed, got like an idea about starting a website. I've never built a website before, but you know, we were not working as much during COVID. So I took some time and tried to learn how to build our website. It still needs, you know, it probably needs to be better than it is, but nonetheless, it functions. And, you know, we just went from there, and then we started blogging at times we really didn't have a great direction, and we really had times where we couldn't put as much effort into it. We've really tried to be stronger with it this year. And, you know, it's been growing.
What is your website? Cause I can have Jay put that here with your logo right up here.
Yeah. It's www.theworkingmom.us.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks.
I love it. Yeah, no, it's cool. It's kind of exactly like what we're doing. It's just like building a community and creating, you know, a platform to do that. And it's like, I think the first step in that is creating the community, which we've been so lucky with all of our regular viewers and all of our guests and, you know, everyone who's been on the show who, you know, is, you know, reaching out to, I mean, a lot of the guest referrals and things too, right? I mean, it's just, it really is a community. It is a network, but it's just like-minded people that come together and can be in a space that's like, okay. Like, you know, sometimes you just got to let it out. You know?
Speaking of, would you be able to connect me with your Amy Breen?
Yeah.
If you would be willing to be on our podcast, because I think she'd be awesome. I'd love to pick her brain a little bit more about her 2 years in the game. And again, just the physician burnout theme.
For sure. Is,
more and more common.
I mean, every episode we talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think, she'd be a great one to talk to. Yeah. And I know I think she's done a couple others. So yeah, we'll do that.
Super awesome. Cool. Yeah. So
good.
Well, listen, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time and this conversation and just, you know, everything. I know it's not easy taking time away after, you know, having a busy clinic day and, you know, a week.
Hopefully this isn't ballroom dancing practice night.
No, last night.
She's like, yeah, I wouldn't have done that. So no, but just taking time out of your busy schedule, you know, operating clinic day, you know, obviously the practices and stuff like that to sit down with us and chat and, you know, just continue to spread the message and, you know, the content that we're trying to create to, you know, give some, you know, objective feedback and, you know, I guess different perception on kind of healthcare in general. And so I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Yeah. My pleasure.
Adrian, everything you're doing, I love. I've been following you for a while on LinkedIn. I love your voice. I love the keep doing it. Don't let anybody talk you out of it, because I think that is exactly the problem that has arisen. People have tried to quiet physicians, and we don't want physicians to talk up. We're supposed to just be the workhorses that go out and just dig the trenches, right? Yep. And it's not acceptable. So keep blazing ahead. You're not alone. I'm here to support you, as are a lot of other people. I love all the other things you're doing with the working moms thing, with your ballroom dancing thing.
Thank you.
And love your carbon leaf thing. And we're seriously going to look into the December 6th.
Yeah. Hey, stay in touch with me and let me know if you come. Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's a Friday night. So it is a possible thing.
Yeah. Thursday, we could leave. Go catch a.
I just have to be back for hunting Saturday morning. No, I'm kidding.
We'll figure it
out. you definitely need to come. It'd be so much fun. I would love to have you guys there.
That'd be awesome. So thank you again for your time.
I guess anyone wants
to get in touch with you too, like other than the working moms thing, how could they find you?
On LinkedIn, on Instagram, on Facebook, I'm there, you know, personal accounts. We have the Working Mom is on all of these sites. The Working Mom is on LinkedIn. We have the Working Mom on Instagram, and then Facebook primarily. We're on Twitter or X or whatever it is a little bit, but our bigger platforms are really Instagram, Facebook, and then LinkedIn too.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for your time. And,
my pleasure. Thank you guys. Great. I had a great time.
Connected.
Sounds good. Okay.
Yeah, all right. You.
All right.
Have a great day.
Take care. Thank you. Bye.
As a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.